Clark live from Westminster. The Conservative Party is expected to form a minority government with the help of the Democratic Unionist Party. Barry Weir reports from Westminster.
Theresa May leaving Downing Street.
How can you stay in your job, Prime Minister?
And despite the reporter questions, it was to Buckingham Palace.
And I will now form a government.
The Prime Minister still has the most MPs, but she's lost the Tory party's majority in the House of Commons. It means her government will need to be propped up by Arlene Foster's Democratic Unionist Party.
We will enter discussions with the Conservatives.
Jeremy Corbyn argues Labour's gains mean he actually won the election.
There isn't a parliamentary majority for anybody at the present time.
Nicola Sturgeon admitted what could have had an impact on the return of 21 fewer seats for her SNP.
The issue of an independence referendum was a factor in this election result.
The Lib Dems gained 4 MPs. UKIP's leaders resigned after they didn't win a single seat.
Theresa May has apologised to the Tory candidates who lost their seats. One of them was Minister for Civil Society, Rob Wilson. He blames the Tory party campaign.
It wasn't an abysmal failure in terms of number of votes and a number of seats. But the campaign itself was a terrible campaign, and it's certainly the worst I've been through by a long, long way.
Meanwhile, Brexit talks are meant to start in 10 days' time. Philip Lagrange, a former economic adviser to the President of the European Commission, he thinks the PM may not be in a position to actually deliver a deal.
We're supposed to have an election about strong and stable government, and it's complete chaos, and the rest of Europe is laughing at us. I mean, they're crying partly because they've always thought that Britain is a pragmatic leading power, and now we look like we are a complete joke. And at the same time, they're despairing because they want to get a deal and get this over and done with.
In sport, Britain's Andy Murray has failed to reach the final of the French Open tennis. The world number one lost his semi-final to Stan Wawrinka in 5 sets. From Sky News, I'm Elizabeth.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. Tony Gosling with me for the first hour tonight. It's leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Noel Gary Hopkins. After the 6 o'clock news, a second terrorist attack in Britain in as many weeks, and the third in 3 months. London Bridge and nearby Borough Market were last Saturday night the scene of both carnage and heroism. 8 people killed and almost 50 seriously injured or otherwise hospitalised. But big questions. Why did the police take several days to release the names when we could have been helping them piece together these maniacs' history? Could it be they didn't want us to see just how close, for the fourth time in as many British terrorist attacks, that 7/7, Westminster Bridge, Manchester and now London Bridge, the perpetrators were to our security services, MI5? And what about the London Bridge attackers' connections over decades to the most extreme and banned groups in Britain? And finally, like the Manchester attackers, Salman Abedi, a local community, reported the ringleader to the anti-terrorist hotline. Police investigated him even for a physical attack in January this year. And they've been banned from local mosques. What else are Muslim communities supposed to do? Imprison suspects themselves to stop them causing mayhem? And what about the motive? In 7/7 Manchester and London Bridge, the terrorists all said it was for the deaths of innocent civilians after the invasion of Iraq. Are these blowback attacks simply a result of British foreign policy the British people don't support? Plus, Qatar ostracised by the Gulf states this week, and Tehran suffers an attack on its parliament and the shrine of their revolutionary Imam Khomeini, its first attack from ISIS. Also, events in the Philippines. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 and dry this weekend. Highs around 21 Celsius, mainly cloudy and breezy, but with some sunny spells. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells and the occasional shower. Next weekend, the 17th of 18th of June, highs of 21, sunny spells. So just a bit of rain next week, but the weekend's pretty clear from rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us understand last night's general election results is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Gary Hopkins from the Lib Dems hasn't arrived yet. So, Martin, we'll start with you. What's your first take-home from the results last night?
Well, obviously, as a Labour Party member, it's the surge in support for the Labour Party.
Oh, yeah, but it wasn't enough, was it? It wasn't enough.
Well, it was enough to stop the government forming an overall majority, and it also ended Theresa May is fatally damaged, as many commentators are now saying.
Well, she doesn't seem to think so.
Well, she may not, but she's made many mistakes so far, and she's going to carry on making mistakes because she's actually a rather cack-handed politician, isn't she?
Well, she has made some gambles and lost. She made the gamble over David Cameron did over Brexit and lost that. And this, it's actually, it started off the Conservatives, didn't they? 20 points ahead in the polls.
Mm. Well, yes, and of course she took that as a kind of endorsement of her policies, and even though people didn't know what the policies were. And she was arrogant. I mean, you know, I don't have to say all of this. The Tory party themselves are saying these things. I think from a Labour Party point of view, one of the things I most enjoyed was watching all the Blairite has-beens in the Labour Party eat their hats, chomp, 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 as the Corbyn effect swept through Britain.
Yeah, but they are still not necessarily 100% behind Jeremy Corbyn, are they? I mean, he's got probably more problems than Theresa May, with a civil war still raging within his own parliamentary group amongst his MPs.
Well, no doubt there are still some people who don't like the direction the party's been taken in. But in actual fact, I feel that they have been largely sidelined by all of this. I mean, the Bristol Labour MPs were all quite hostile to Corbyn. And I think they've all, in fact, increased their majorities.
I don't think Karen Smith in Bristol South was.
I think all three of them were involved in the chicken coup. There's no doubt about it.
All of them genuinely believed that it was Jeremy Corbyn should be given a second test to see if he really was the best leader, a bit like the second referendum.
The rules of the Labour Party are clear. If people want to run a campaign, a leadership campaign, they can, and they did, and they lost, and they still carried on moaning. And I think the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It's quite clear that Jeremy Corbyn has put a 10% surge on Labour's vote from a very low level because of the internal infighting that we had. And the fact that he's not managed to form a government is not really his fault. It's, if it's anybody's fault, it's the people who are attacking him. He's actually clearly managed to mobilise large numbers of people who didn't vote before. Millions of people who registered to vote who didn't vote previously have come out and voted. And that is an incredible achievement. And you can't take it away from him. He's been a fantastic campaigner. He's won two elections in a row inside the Labour Party, and he's also basically fatally wounded.
Well, we'll say he can draw great crowds, thousands of people, like a rock star, but he can't win an election.
Well, he can't win an election. Let's put it this way: under first past the post, it's very hard to win an election against the Tory Party in this country because it's rigged, which is now why the Tory Party.
Well, okay, in what way is it rigged?
It's rigged because, in actual fact, most of the votes counted, most of the votes that are cast aren't counted. It's only in marginal seats that those votes make any difference at all. So, in actual fact, most of the people who participated in the election on Thursday, only a tiny minority of them, their votes will count for anything. Different, of course, in elections in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales, because they've moved towards proportional representation in those three Celtic fringe countries.
And the rest of Europe.
And, of course, there's going to be a real problem for Theresa May now. She goes into negotiations, for example, with the Irish government, with the DUP on board, is that she hasn't got 50% plus one of the British people behind. Everybody else she'll be speaking with across the European table will have 50% plus one and a solid mandate.
Well, her fault, is it?
Well,
it's the fault of the electoral system.
It's the British electoral system, but it means that her negotiating position is fatally weak because don't represent the people of Britain.
Changing the electoral system is a discussion for another day, Martin.
No, it's
this
not.
Yes, it is. Inside the DUP, this has suddenly become, the DUP has suddenly become crucial, hasn't it?
That's right, because the electoral system makes them crucial.
10 votes. Yeah, well, as I said, we'll talk about the electoral system another day. What we're talking about today is the electoral system we've got and the results we got last night. Inside the DUP is 10 MPs Who are going to be deciding the fate of the Conservative Party, issue by issue, apparently.
They're going to be deciding the fate of Britain and Brexit. But, of course, the whole question is, what kind of Brexit are they going to push for? Is it going to be a hard border or a soft border?
Well, they're certainly going to get
and,
their
and
way,
also there comes they? Questions about legitimacy. In Northern Ireland, in the six counties, the majority voted
Martin,
to remain
Martin,
inside the EU.
I know you've got a big thing
no,
about this
No, I'm talking about the referendum now.
I'm talking about legitimacy. I know
no, I'm talking about the DUP
the
have
day,
got a legitimacy problem as
the
well.
At the end of the day, we've got a result tonight. Yeah?
Yes, I'm just going to point out that the DUP have got a legitimacy problem as well.
And the DUP... and what's happened on Ireland is actually one of the main issues, isn't it? About
it is.
About the border. So
it
they
is.
Will be having probably getting their way. What do you think is going to happen with that border?
Well, I'm just pointing out to you, the DUP have got a problem, which is the six counties voted to remain in the EU. Now, what the rest of the parties in the rest of Britain are saying, that vote is sacrosanct. We voted to leave the EU, but the six counties voted to stay. Now, the DUP want to leave the EU, but in actual fact, they've got a referendum decision which overrides a voting in election decision, which says that they've got to stay in the EU. So they've got a real problem.
Well, they're
there.
Going to be rather torn, aren't they?
Well, they're going to have a real problem finessing that.
And I'll put a link up to our show page about the DUP. He's one of the greatest political journalists in Northern Ireland ever, from the Belfast Telegraph. And he's written an article a few years ago all about the DUP, an investigation really into it. His name's Liam Clark, and he died, I think, about a year and about 18 months ago. But in his investigation, he discovered that almost all the members of the DUP are both Free Presbyterians, or a lot of them are Free Presbyterians, but and members of the Orange Order. But actually, when it comes to their MPs, they're almost all Free Presbyterians and all members of the Orange Order. So when it comes to becoming a candidate for the DWP, the first question is, are you in the order?
Yeah, I don't think there's much doubt about that. It's so the Orange Order's is the Orange Order's political
can
wing.
Can you explain? Can you explain what the Free Presbyterian Church and the Orange Order are?
Well, the Free Presbyterian Church was, I think, if I'm right, it was a church set up by Ian Paisley. So it's actually Ian Paisley's church.
The Church of Ian Paisley.
Yeah, I mean he set it up. I mean. It's not a long-running denomination. It's his denomination. And the Orange Order, of course, has been there since the 18th century to uphold Protestant supremacy in Ireland. Now, I don't think the modern
is it anything something to do with William of Orange?
Yes, that's right. That's why it's called the Orange Order. It's after William of Orange.
So tell us about him. This is fascinating.
Well, William of Orange became King of England in the Glorious Revolution of 1688, when James I was second was driven out for being a Catholic. He was from Holland, where the House of Orange had become the, you know, stadtholders, as they were called. But, of course, the original Orange is in France, in the south of France, and that's where the original family came from. But, of course, in terms of...
So Orange is a family name, simply, is it?
Well, it was originally a region of south of France where a family came from, and they eventually became the rulers in Holland, and then, of course, the rulers of Britain, and, of course, then, of course, the whole Orange... what Orange means in historical terms, in Irish terms, is
so this
Protestant
was
ascendancy.
Just after the English Civil War, what had happened was you had a kind of bit of a resurgence of Catholicism, people saying, well, actually, maybe the Catholics aren't so bad after all, they've been
James II.
So what was this Glorious Revolution
all
about?
Well, James II, who was Charles II's brother, he came to the throne because Charles II, although he got many illegitimate children, hadn't got any legitimate ones. And so his brother came to the throne, but his brother was a not-so-secret, and once he became onto the throne, a Catholic. And, of course, the way in which the settlement of the Restoration when Charles had come back to power was that he could come back to power, but that he couldn't... you know, there wouldn't be a Catholic king in Britain. In fact, Charles II converted to Catholicism on his deathbed. But, of course, the Protestant...
He'd been a secret Catholic, really. Yeah.
Well, he was a secret Catholic, yeah. Basically. And that was, of course...
So this is all tied up with this whole sectarian thing between
yes.
Protestants and Catholics?
Yes. I mean, and of course, in modern Irish politics, this continues. Of course, and to some extent, you find this in Glasgow and other places. But I mean, that's the Irish question is clearly going to be front and centre of what's going to happen in Britain now, which was always going to be the case, even if Theresa May had won a handsome victory. The first thing she would have to do is sort out the Irish border. Now I think the positive thing is I saw a spokesperson for the DUP on the TV, and he was saying, "Well, we don't want a hard border." Now, that's hopeful, because if they don't want a hard border, then I think that a deal can be done, because there's no reason to have a hard border in Ireland. But of course,
it reminds
that means
me
that we're moving towards a soft Brexit.
Well, I mean, I can remember as I lived over there during the Troubles, and there was a very hard border with all army checkpoints and all that sort of thing.
Yes, and nobody wants to go back there, and I think the DUP don't want to go back there. I mean, if the DUP had a more extreme position that they did want a hard border, then the whole thing really would be very dangerous, because, in other words, the Tory government would be propping up a sectarian statelet with a kind of a supremacist ideology. But I think the DUP have come a long way. The Good Friday Agreement is still in force. And I think a compromise deal could probably be worked out. But I think what this does do is it starts to make Brexit look softer and softer for Theresa May. And I think that will be a problem, because some people on the right of her party, not the DUP, but on the right of her party, won't like the idea of a soft Brexit.
So is the DUP a political wing of the Free Presbyterians?
Well, it's a political wing of the Orange Order. That's what it is. Some people claim that Sinn Féin is the political wing of the IRA,
okay,
although the IRA is disbanded.
Okay, so how does that leave the whole Northern Ireland division and the suspension of Stormont?
Well, what's happened is that both Sinn Féin and the DUP have cleaned up in both of their respective communities. I mean, they're both dominant. There's only one MP who's been elected as an independent, a moderate unionist. And I think the DUP the moderate unionists who voted to remain in the EU have clearly swung behind the DUP because they're worried that Sinn Féin are getting too strong. Now, this could lead, in another era, this would have been a very dangerous result in Northern Ireland with a very polarised electorate. But I think, in actual fact, the DUP and Sinn Féin know each other very, very well. They've worked pretty
but
well
Martin,
together in,
I mean,
in the past, and I don't think there's any
Sinn
reason why they can't do so in the future.
Sinn Féin have gained three MPs, although their MPs don't take up their seats in
That's
Westminster.
Right.
We're in a quite interesting situation.
If they did,
now,
then Theresa May wouldn't be able to form a government.
Isn't that interesting? So if they're still, hey guys over there, you know, you could decide to send your MPs to.
Well,
Westminster.
They won't, because it's just too.
What is the principle behind that then?
Well, the principle behind that is we want to have a united Ireland, and therefore we're not going to sit in Westminster parliaments. I mean, if you think back to 1918, where
but so much has changed in Ireland because of MPs that were sent from Ireland to Westminster.
Yes, I know, but
over the years, for example, the liberation of the land in Ireland was all because of Irish MPs in Westminster holding the balance of power. Surely Sinn Féin can see this.
Yeah, but you've got to remember that the SDLP do take their seats in Parliament, in Westminster Parliament, but they've been wiped out. Sinn Féin have cleaned up. And Sinn Féin's position, ever since the Doyle of 1918, they won the election across Ireland, and instead of going to Westminster, they formed an Irish Parliament. That was the basis of the modern Irish state. And Sinn Féin's position has always been that we're not taking up our seats in Westminster. In actual fact, they used to have an office in Westminster, and they used to go and use the office, but they didn't go into the chamber, and they don't vote on British.
Okay, well, let's just run through some of the headlines. Now the results are settled down. So the Conservatives have lost their Commons majority, the largest party, and it's a hung parliament. Theresa May says she will form a government with the 10 Democratic Unionist Party MPs. She says she's sorry to colleagues that's lost their seats, and we'll go talk about that a bit in a minute. Jeremy Corbyn says she should quit. Conservatives plus 10 DUP MPs may have 329 seats, more than all the other parties put together. Final score of 319 seats for the Tories, down 13. Also, a progressive alliance between Labour, SNP, Lib Dems, Plaid Cymru and Greens would have about 10 less than the majority. Paul Nuttall for UKIP has resigned with an absolute collapse in the UKIP vote. Interestingly, most of those votes seem to have gone to Labour, looking at some of the results around the country. The Lib Dems didn't do very well. We had some interesting people lost their seats as well. Political casualties of all this, Martin. Cabinet Office Minister Ben Gummer has lost his Ipswich seat to Labour. Theresa May's chief of staff, Nick Timothy, lost his he was one of the people who was responsible for writing the general election manifesto. In a way, this is a sort of a cross against his name for that manifesto, which has been so widely criticised. Also, Treasury Minister Jane Ellison was beaten by Labour in Battersea. City Minister Simon Kirby lost out to Labour in Brighton Kempstown, where Labour took over there. And in Croydon Central, the Housing Minister Gavin Barwell was given his marching orders by voters who backed Labour. So interesting, isn't it? Five ministers have lost their seats.
Yeah. I think it's she may be able to cobble together a coalition with the DUP. You see, if the DUP were to join everybody else, we could have a rainbow coalition and the Tories out. But the DUP, of course, are quite hostile to progressive
politics.
The name
of the Tory party actually originates in Northern Ireland, doesn't it?
Well, it's the Conservative and Unionist party, so the in actual fact...
Yeah, but they've dropped the Unionists. They've suddenly remembered it again.
No, the Ulster Unionists are the sister party of the Conservative Party in Northern Ireland, but they've been wiped out by the DUP.
Now, what about the Tory Island and the origin of this nickname of the Tory party?
Well, the Tory Island was an island off the north coast of Ireland, and it was notoriously a nest of ne'er-do-wells and robbers in the 17th century, and so the politicians in Westminster called the Tories, the Whig politicians called the Tories the Tories, because they were accusing them of being kind of gangsters and Jacobites and what have you, and it stuck, like lots of things have stuck, you know, and instead of being an insult, it's just become a description.
Also, Nick Clegg, Alex Salmond and Angus Robertson, the leader of the Scottish Nationalists in the House of Commons, have gone.
Well, that's a very interesting story of the night, isn't it? Because if the Scottish Conservatives hadn't done so well...
Well, Labour did very well up there as
well.
Yes,
I know, but the Scottish Conservatives did particularly well in taking seats from the SNP. If the SNP had been able to hold their end of the vote up, then Theresa May wouldn't be able to form a government. But because there was a bit of a Tory surge in posh parts of Scotland...
Well, it wasn't so much a Tory surge, I think, as an SNP collapse. It's just like, now, with Nicola Sturgeon as the leader of the SNP, people just don't want to vote SNP
anymore. The SNP...
They're going back to what they were working
before.
No,
well, I mean, what you're getting is the SNP is a left-of-centre party. Now, what the Tories have been managed to do is they've managed to persuade middle-class Scots that they're not left-of-centre and the SNP's too radical for them.
Which is, the SNP have lost a third of their seats, Martin. This is people just recoiling from Sturgeon.
Well, but they've still got the most seats in Scotland. I mean, under first past the post, they didn't. What's interesting is they didn't win 50% plus one in the popular vote. Labour, but they've certainly got the majority.
Labour have gained more than half, exactly half of what the Conservatives had. So, if the rural constituencies, of course, which are the majority in Scotland, the Tories have taken those, and many of the urban constituencies, Labour have taken.
Yeah, well, they've been squeezed
the
at both ends, haven't they? They've been in the rural areas, they've been squeezed by the Tories, and in the urban areas, they've been squeezed by
and
the Labour Party.
SNP have lost a colossal 21 MPs up in Scotland. So this is fascinating.
Yes, it's been a bad night for them, yeah. I think that's probably put off a Scottish independence referendum for, you know, quite a considerable period now. I don't think there's going to be any talk about that we're going to be talking about United Ireland rather than independent Scotland, I think.
Also worth mentioning that Nicola Sturgeon is also a member of this European Council on Foreign Relations. She goes along to all their meetings, or many of those, which is actually a big US think tank. So do you think maybe she's just been a bit too wooed by the Americans and their plans for a United States of Europe?
Well, I think that they're a pro-EU party, as we know, and, you know, I don't think that's going to change. I think many of the Conservatives in Scotland are actually pro-EU. They're not really Remain Conservative, Leave Conservatives. So that might change the balance of power in the Tory party a bit, because I think the Scots Conservatives are actually more centrist than the English Conservatives.
OK, well, Gary Hopkins has arrived now, and I think before we give him a chance to get his breath back, let's have a listen to Theresa May's speech outside 10 Downing Street today, and then we'll discuss how much of what she says is really going to happen.
I have just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, and I will now form a government. A government that can provide certainty and lead Britain forward at this critical time for our country. This government will guide the country through the crucial Brexit talks that begin in just 10 days. and to deliver on the will of the British people by taking the United Kingdom out of the European Union. It will work to keep our nation safe and secure by delivering the change that I set out following the appalling attacks in Manchester and London, cracking down on the ideology of Islamist extremism and all those who support it, and giving the police and the authorities the powers they need to keep our country safe. The government I lead will put fairness and opportunity at the heart of everything we do, so that we will fulfil the promise of Brexit together and, over the next 5 years, build a country in which no one and no community is left behind. A country in which prosperity and opportunity are shared right across this United Kingdom. What the country needs more than ever is certainty. And having secured the largest number of votes and the greatest number of seats in the general election, it is clear that only the Conservative and Unionist Party has the legitimacy and ability to provide that certainty by commanding a majority in the House of Commons. As we do, we will continue to work with our friends and allies in the Democratic Unionist Party in particular. Our two parties have enjoyed a strong relationship over many years, and this gives me the confidence to believe that we will be able to work together in the interests of the whole United Kingdom. This will allow us to come together as a country and channel our energies towards a successful Brexit deal that works for everyone in this country, securing a new partnership with the EU which guarantees our long-term prosperity. That's what people voted for last June. That's what we will deliver. Now let's get to work.
Now, fine words. Theresa May, Prime Minister, is reading out there, Gary, but how much of it will come to pass, do you think?
Well, I think it's a mess. Quite frankly, I think she's deluded if she feels that she can carry on exactly as she has done, that because she's got a temporary position where some rather, should we say, right-wing people in the Democratic Unionist Party will have voted through her Queen's Speech. When it comes to negotiation with the EU, there's going to be one heck of a mess, and there are, believe it or not, quite a number of sensible people within the Conservative Party, including some of those elected in Scotland, who are going to have nothing to do with the way that she wants to go, and she'll be pulled back, and I think we'll finish up with her not lasting out probably no more than a year.
What about the whole premise the election was based on, with the 20 points ahead in the polls? She was looking for a much increased majority. Actually, what's happened is she's shot herself in the foot.
Well, machine gunned it off, more like, just shot it. I mean, the whole thing was obvious right from the beginning, was a complete sham. And it was, quite frankly, the second time within a short period of time that a Conservative Prime Minister has gambled with the future of the country in a very reckless manner and done extreme danger.
But what isn't, surely going to the country is not gambling. It's what it's saying is, look, we're not sure about this. Let's just get a proper mandate to do it.
A proper mandate. Well, it doesn't look like a proper mandate now, does it? She actually had a majority. Yes, she thought she had an absolute basket case as a leader of the opposition, and quite frankly, under any other circumstances, I don't think that the Labour Party's structure and leadership and programme would have got anything like sensible support, but people were frankly outraged by her arrogant behaviour.
What about Jeremy Corbyn? How do you think? Because he seems to have done quite well. People were predicting that this was, in fact, our local MPs here, that he was really not capable of leading the party. And actually, he seems to have, on his little rock star tour around the country, seems to have led to a bit of a Labour surge.
Well, he has. The difference, though, between leading a great protest arrangement and a huge protest against the way that the government is behaving and actually running the country is a very large one.
What about the loss of Charlotte Leslie, Conservative seat here in Bristol? We've got four Labour MPs now.
Well, it's difficult to comment to know which is worse, actually, Charlotte Leslie or a replacement.
Can you explain? Tell us a little bit about the new MP there. I think, is it... who is the new MP?
Darren Jones.
Well, I don't know him personally very well, but, I mean, he stood... last time, disappeared for a couple of years and then reappeared again just before the election and has managed to persuade enough people to vote for him. So I think that the so-called quality and talents of Charlotte Leslie were somewhat overstated.
The Darren Jones, he's actually a Londoner. Do you think that matters, Martin?
Well, I don't know him at all well. As a Londoner, and he's a lawyer, I understand. I think all four Labour MPs in Bristol, and they've been very sceptical about Jeremy Corbyn. They've actually seen a Corbyn effect. I mean, Thangam Devonair.
Just to be
Christian
fair
West
to him,
has definitely seen a big Corbyn effect.
Just to be fair to him, he's living in London now, and that's maybe why we haven't seen him over the last year, Gary. But he's from Shirehampton, apparently, or he's lived in Shirehampton for a while. Anyway, Martin.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, it's not because he's Darren Jones that he's won the seat. He's won the seat because there's been a swing to Labour in urban areas.
Well, I mean, he's been very close to various people who are quite high up in the Labour Party, which is quite clearly why he was put into that seat. He was South West chair of Andy Burnham's leadership campaign in 2016, and he was a chair of Marvin Rees's mayoral campaign last year too.
Yes, so he has got some track record down here. But as I say, I'm not taking anything away from his victory. I mean, he only just beat Charlotte Leslie. There's only a couple of thousand votes in it. And we always used to have that seat when Doug Naismith held it. But I think there's been, one of the things I've most enjoyed, Gary, as you can probably imagine, is watching the right wing of the Labour Party eating hats at 6 o'clock in the morning, because they've all basically had to accept that Corbyn has been an excellent campaigner, and for example, the millions of people who registered to vote since the election have called, have registered to vote and turned up, and it's made a difference.
Another result, another personality who's gone is the Liberal Democrats ejected Public Health Minister Nicola Blackwood in Oxford West and Abingdon. So the Greens pulled out of the contest there to give you a clean chance at taking out the sitting Tory, Gary.
Yeah, there's been two or three cases where the Greens have not fielded candidates, and I don't think we stood against the Green leader either, Caroline Lucas. I mean, we do have some things in common with them. We do have some things where we don't have. The Green Party is made up of a coalition of those who are actually rather Corbynite and those who are, quite frankly, environmentally with the Liberal Democrats. So,
well, Bristol West is one of the most interesting ones. That's turned out as a massively increased majority, plus 30% for Thangam Debonair and Labour. And also, Molly Scott-Cato for the Greens and Stephen Williams for the Lib Dems were beaten into third and fourth place by the Conservatives. Actually quite a good show in Bristol West, Gary.
Well, I think rather than the Conservatives having a good show, I think it's rather both the Greens and Liberal Democrats did not do well. I think that's more the case, and what happened was that huge numbers of people, not just in that seat but everywhere else, were saying we're voting Labour to get rid of, to bury the Conservatives. And it's interesting, in some seats around that tactical situation, in some seats in other parts of the country, where it was clearly either Liberal Democrats or Conservatives, actually there's a tactical switch to the Liberal Democrats. So more people seem to be prepared to vote tactically this time than has been the case before.
Not good for Stephen Williams, though, is it? I mean, it was two terms as MP there, and it looks like his history now.
It wasn't a good result.
What do you think about the Lib Dems all across the country, generally?
Well, it was a very patchy position. We actually finished up with a few more seats than we started the election with. We've, you know, made a bit of a comeback in Scotland.
Yeah, you've got four. It's plus four. Maybe I should just read the figures out. Conservative minus 12, Labour plus 29, which is pretty good. Actually, this the thing I'm reading is, I better be quick, SNP minus 21, Lib Dem plus 4, DUP plus 2, and others minus 2. So that would be people like UKIP. But, yeah, not a bad show, Gary.
Well, it isn't as good as we started the campaign looking for. Having said that, there was basically a polarisation. And surprisingly, I mean, commentators would have looked at a left-wing Labour Party. It certainly was far more left-wing than it has been in recent years, and quite frankly, a very right-wing Conservative Party, and thought there was quite a big space in the middle somewhere. But quite frankly, that didn't get the support that a lot of people thought it might do.
Filton and Bradley Stoke on the fringes of the city. We've had the sitting MP, Conservative MP Jack Lopresti, has been re-elected, Martin, but his majority has been slashed, cut to around 4,000 from 10,000.
And who came second?
Who came second? Bristol, North, Filton and Bradley Stoke, Labour.
Labour.
Naomi Rylett for Labour.
Yeah, well, can I
with
just
a plus 15% swing to Labour.
Yeah,
there.
Can I just make the point? I think that this hung Parliament result still raises the question, Gary, of the electoral system.
Yes.
Because we're now in a situation where mandates matter. We've got a situation where we've got referendums which supposedly create mandates for elected governments. We've now got coalitions being formed, which, I mean, if you add the DUP vote to the Tory vote, it doesn't add up to 50% of the electorate. And this is going to matter as you're going to make or break negotiations with other European countries who have modernised electoral systems.
Well, you certainly won't have me disagreeing with you there. That proportional representation is an actual must in a modern democracy.
Also, the other constituency that's quite interesting is Kingswood. That's an increased majority for Chris Skidmore. He's now on 55% of the vote, added 6.6%, and Labour a second with Vary Threlfall there. So that's actually a ringing endorsement, Martin, for the Conservatives.
Well, looks the Conservative
if,
Party...
looks as if, basically, what's happened there is the UKIP... because there's no UKIP standing in Kingswood, everyone's voted Tory. And this has happened in many places, although actually quite a lot of... either voted Labour or Tory, but in this case it looks like Tory.
Well, the Tories have done quite well. They've actually increased their vote share. And therefore, in some parts of the country, like Kingswood, that stood them in good stead. But, of course, Labour's share went up more, and it was enough under First Past the Post to fatally break their legs. I mean, First Past the Post is a lottery. I mean, if a few hundred thousand or tens of thousands of voters had voted a different way last night, we'd have a completely different political complexion to look at. And that, I think people need to ask themselves the question, do we want to carry on having elections like this, which is such a lottery, or do we really want to have something more stable where we actually know, where we can predict
the
results?
Back at the 2010 election, people were asked, do you want the alternative vote, which was to change the system, and they said no.
Alternative vote certainly is not a proportional system. It was a dog's breakfast, and quite frankly, I'm afraid Nick Clegg made a very serious mistake by accepting that as the basis of the referendum, and I'm afraid the Labour Party also failed to support that, although it would have been a modest improvement. And I think also, as well as the actual result, and yes, we, as a party, we suffered a small number of MPs. I mean, we had one of our key people who lost by two votes, and a number of others who lost by very small amounts. But the party, the party that won here, Conservative Party, is a coalition that's formed because of the system. I mean, anybody who thinks that Kenneth Clark is in the same Conservative Party as Theresa May is deluded.
Well, they were both Remainers, weren't they?
Well, yes, but Kenneth Clark actually meant it. And was able to explain in coherent terms why it was important. I think she was there because it was convenient to her political future at the time.
Now, over in Wales, we were told that it was going to be some sort of Conservative landslide about a month ago, but the actual result is that Labour's hailed fantastic results over there. Labour has gained three seats. The Conservatives have lost three seats, Plaid Cymru has gained one and the Lib Dems have lost one. So Martin, this looks... this is the Corbyn effect, isn't it, in Wales, from the original polls back in the end of April. This was going to be a disaster, Wales, and Corbyn has turned it round.
I think that's right. I mean, we need to analyse it more, you know, critically. I think what's very interesting is that the UKIP vote in Wales and elsewhere in the North East has collapsed to Labour. And I think the Tories were under the misapprehension, if people voted to leave the European Union, that they were natural Tories. And I think that's been shown to be completely wrong. People voted to leave the European Union for whatever reasons they voted for it, but their fundamental loyalties are not Tory. I mean, when they look at the Tory party, the modern Tory party, with its plutocratic agenda, they don't recognise themselves within that. And, of course, once UKIP collapses, I mean, the referendum's over now, that issue is to some extent settled, and people are much more concerned about jobs, housing, and so on. And the Labour Party put together a pretty detailed manifesto to address those grievances.
Also in Stroud, I mean, this is Gloucestershire was completely Conservative up until there is now someone called David Drew. The Labour actually took Stroud, despite the fact, of course, that you've got quite a lot of people voting Green up in Stroud, which would erode his vote. David Drew's beat Conservative Neil Carmichael by 681 votes, a little oasis of red in the sea of Gloucestershire blue.
Well, Labour also took Canterbury with a majority of 10,000, which is a seat we've never held ever. Now, that is the effect of Corbyn's appeal to younger people. I think that's pretty clear.
Say never. I mean, it was as recent as 1919 that the Labour Party actually held Canterbury, so it's not never.
Well, it's quite a long time ago, though, isn't it?
Also, quite a lot of MPs in London. I mean, there seems to be quite a swing to Labour in London too, Gary. Overall, though, I mean, you look a little bit jealously and think, well, maybe if we had somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, because, of course, Nick Clegg has been kicked out, your previous leader. There's not a ringing endorsement. He seems that he's not kind of caught the spirit of the nation. And it might be just simply the fact that he's going against the referendum vote.
Well, I think people look at it that way. And, of course, our message through this campaign has been warning about the effects of Brexit and saying how damaging it is actually going to be. And, of course, people haven't actually seen that. They haven't seen the effects. We are still within the European Union. And the Conservatives, to a large extent, managed to persuade people, don't worry, it'll be okay, it'll be fine. So our message, we look like doom-mongers. And therefore, it didn't work in a number of places. It has worked in others.
I think one of the things I always try and think of when it comes to general elections is the people that maybe don't have a vote or don't get to vote. For example, a lot of homeless people simply don't have the ability to be allowed to vote, even if they can actually find a computer, go to the right office and get to vote. And then they don't necessarily get told, because they're homeless, where to vote, that sort of thing. So we've got a dialect programme actually next week on Tuesday at noon, which is looking at a couple of aspects of homeless life for the homeless here in Bristol. And I'm going to play a little clip from a guy called James. This is the sort of situation people are in, folks, once they become homeless. If you try and get a roof over your head, like, for example, by squatting, you can come across some of the most horrendous rogue bailiffs. And there's this firm now in Bristol called GRC, which is boasting on its website that they will evict people by force without going to court. So before we hear that clip, what do you make of that, Martin?
Well, the point about squatting is it is actually a legal activity, and there are all sorts of legal things around it. The police, the police in Bristol have understood that it's not illegal for people to squat, and the bailiffs have to work within the law.
But what happens when you're squatting legally, a firm of bailiffs like GRC turn up with balaclavaed people with effectively looking like thugs, smash their way into your home, you call the police, and the police don't really do anything. They just let them carry on. They don't arrest them.
Well, the fact is that everybody's supposed to play by the rules. And let's just make sure that everybody does.
I mean, this is the sort of thing, Gary, which is quite common when it comes to gypsy and traveller evictions, where landowners don't go to court. They just hire bailiffs to just come in mob-handed.
Yeah, I think the problem is that people get frustrated and they feel that the law and that the processes which protect people are getting in their way of getting what they individually want. And the problem is that the bailiffs are an unpleasant but unnecessary requirement of a legal society.
But do you think
it should be a last resort?
But do you think
clearly
they should
these people are not acting as bailiffs, they're acting as thugs.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to James describing what happened to him at 5 o'clock in the morning a couple of weeks ago.
In this case, what happened was the owner turned up at this building. I won't actually say the company owner at the moment. He was declined to communicate with us at all, got straight on the phone to his lawyer. Again, this building had been derelict for around about 3-4 years. It was the one in Fishponds which they actually wanted to turn into a McDonald's drive-through. There had been a lot of strong local opposition towards this. They'd had their application turned down, but they put in for an appeal. So the next thing we know, at 4:45 in the morning, it was on Tuesday the 18th of May, if I remember correctly, got awoken up by a big commotion outside. There were actually 8 guys outside all wearing balaclavas and who were also armed with batons and CS spray trying to smash their way in for the double glazing door at the front. At this point, I got the phone to the police straight away, made a 999 call, and said, you know, there are persons here who are trying to break in. And they said, yep, send the car around straight away. I then kept in contact on that 999 call. These guys then realised they weren't going to get in through the front, so they then tried to get in back. They managed to force their way in through a gap around the back. 2 guys jumped in, which I then demanded they actually identify themselves, because they hadn't. They never said they were bailiffs, they never said this is an eviction, even their insignia wasn't particularly well displayed. And I asked them, I said, UGRC. Now, the first communication that we actually have with these guys is the one guy basically says, get out, get the out. That's what they, you know, the first thing they said. In fact, one of the bailiffs was in such an agitated state that one of the occupiers actually had to say to him, look, mate, you need to calm down, start taking deep breaths. They then said, you know, you've got to get out of here. The guy that appeared to be the boss, I asked him if he had a court order. He said, yeah, we've got one. I said, can I see it? And he said, oh, I slipped up my body armour on the way in here. And so afterwards, we did actually find a document that had been left on the ground, but it was not a legal document. Now, the police did actually turn up outside, but they did appear to be quite apathetic about the situation. So these guys basically forced entry.
So hang on a minute. Let's just stop a second, because you have you're lawfully in possession of that building as a squatter. You have a legal right to use that building. And you call the police, someone's trying to break in. Those people, how did they persuade the police that they had a right to break in?
Well, by the time the police got in there, they were already in. I think one car first turned up with 2 officers there. They then went away and a whole van load turned up. Now, I was actually inside the building at the time, kind of getting packed up and this sort of stuff, but the police just stood on and viewed the whole proceedings. They weren't interested in getting involved.
So what do you put this down to? I mean, what was their, did they have a legal right to do what they did? Were the police right to stand aside?
I don't believe they did. The police never talked to us. You know, I asked the guy for the court order, he failed to show one. I don't believe they actually did have a court order. I believe the police should have asked them to see the paperwork. I don't believe they did. So in this case, it was an illegal eviction. And, you know, I vote for the police acted adequately. This is the third time that I know they've done this in the Bristol area in the past 6 months. I do know they're registered locally. The guys that were there are all Welsh. I believe they're from around the Cardiff area.
Now, Martin, I mean, you're an ex-squatter, so am I. This sort of thing is actually a lot cheaper, isn't it, to hire a bunch of people to break in rather than actually go to court?
Well, I think that's the fact is that everybody's got to obey the rules. Now, if they haven't got a court order, they can't just bash their way in. And if they've got a court order, then you should evict, you know, you should leave. That's always been the rules. And you've been a squatter, I've been a squatter. If they've got a court order, you should just leave in an orderly fashion, and tidy up any mess that might be there. But of course, they shouldn't. I mean, it's dangerous for people to go bashing their way into houses with baseball bats and so on. People could easily get hurt, bailiffs or squatters or anybody, and that's why you shouldn't do it.
Gary, the suspicion here is, I mean, there is. It looks like the sort of reason that landlords will do things like this is they think, oh, well, they're only squatters, they haven't got any money for a solicitor, and anyway, they can't get legal aid.
That might well be the case. I don't know enough about the individual circumstances, but clearly everybody must follow the rules, and there must be sanctions against those who fail to do it. I mean, there are horrible echoes here of, when things don't go the way of government, they want to avoid human rights and say that they're an inconvenience and getting in the way of what people want. I'm afraid that people do have rights. They must be protected. And basically our best protection against terrorists is not to actually just rip up all the rules and carry on. It is to actually respect people's views, to actually behave in a legal manner.
What do you make of the attacks in London as well? Because balaclavaed people, it just with batons, almost sounds like the sort of kind of terror attack, that kind of thing. And it's the sort of thing at 5 o'clock in the morning, which is it's likely to actually start a massive fight could easily start in this sort of situation. But anyway, look, let's ignore the squatting for a minute. What do you make of London Bridge?
Well, I'm afraid that there are people who have an evil ideology that must be tackled, but the way that you tackle them is not by curtailing other people's rights. You must have the right resources, you must have the persistence to actually deal with these people. And from my experience of dealing with, for example, a Muslim community in Bristol, they are the people who have most invested in making certain that these people are caught and exposed. And it's extremely concerning now. These last two attacks, we've had indications that the nature of the people have been reported to the authorities, and there seems to be a failure to get to grips with them.
Yeah, so both attacks, the ringleader last weekend and in Manchester, Salman Abedi, were reported multiple times to the police and on the anti-terrorist hotline, and also banned from mosques. So, as I said at the top of the hour, you're in a situation, aren't you, where you've done all you can. Are the Muslim community actually supposed to arrest these people themselves? I mean, because all you can do, surely, is just to report, saying, look, this guy is a potential terrorist, and make sure that they're banned from the mosque. What else are people supposed to do?
Well, to say, in my experience, the vast majority of the Muslim community are horrified by what actually happens with these people, and are doing their best to protect the rest of us in society. And it's up to the authorities to act efficiently and not, as Mrs. May is calling for, demand ever-increasing powers to shortcut the law.
Well, we'll be talking about this in the second hour as well, but it does beggars the question, doesn't it? How does censoring the internet stop people hiring a van and buying knives? Because that's all that these guys needed to do in order to carry out their attack last weekend.
I think we ought to be glad that we haven't got Donald Trump in charge. Otherwise, a few dead with knives, nasty and unpleasant and appalling that it is, would have been an awful lot more as they went steaming in with submachine guns.
Also today, I was just noticing an article in the Jewish Chronicle, anger over Star of David symbol on Labour poster. Well, they call it Labour poster in the Jewish Chronicle, but actually it's a pro-Corbyn poster, which isn't put there by the Labour Party. Martin, Corbyn supporters in Bristol erect a banner showing the Star of David earrings on Theresa May. The police have intervened and got them to take it down. It was in the bear pit to highlight May's relationship with Israel.
Well, Was she wearing the earrings?
Yes, no, she was. They were just painted on.
They were painted on her.
Yeah.
Well, you could argue that that's just legitimate political knockabout, isn't it? You know, we know that she's pro-Israel, and many other politicians are.
Gary, what do you make of this? Is it right for the police to wade in and say that's we've got to take that down because it's anti-Semitic or it's a kind of religious hate or that kind of thing?
I think the problem here is that the mix-up in the boundaries between people being concerned about the way that the Israeli state has actually behaved on a number of occasions and being anti-Semitic. It is not the same thing, but it is in a heated atmosphere. The two things can get very mixed up and very dangerous.
You've got to think about, I suppose, cartoons, haven't you? Because we've also had in the Bristolian this the cartoon of Marvin Rees, the mayor, with the greatest cut of all written across it, with a meat cleaver in the top of his head. You know, this is a cartoon. Is that so offensive that it should be taken down? Or, you know, as I understand it, reading the Bristolian, you're never quite entirely sure, but the council looks as if the council have taken this as a serious death threat.
Well, I can't think that it's a serious death threat. It's unpleasant, and I think over the top. But you know, bluntly, I think it's anger again, and people being allowing their feelings to get completely out of control and out of context.
Also, hopes for a new harbour patrol in Bristol. Six people have died in Bristol's waters since January this year. A new organisation called the Inland Water Safety Group is hoping to launch a patrol boat service for the floating harbour. God knows where they're going to find the money for that from. But the group has got the backing of Alinka Gurji, the mother of Jason Gurgel, who died in the water earlier this year. What do you make of this spate of people dying in the water, Gary?
Well, people do silly things when they've had too much to drink.
Martin?
Yeah, well, it's potentially dangerous, isn't it? I mean, they're very steep-sided, those things, and if you fall in, you're not going to get out very easily, are you? And, you know, people need to take a bit of a care.
Well, some people are putting a sinister tone on it, saying, well, actually, this is many more people than normal dying in the water in the city.
Well, I think the people have been drowning in that harbour for a very long time. Hundreds of years.
Finally, ex-BBC presenters Julie and Tony Wadsworth guilty of indecently assaulting underage boys and having sex in a woodland. The husband and wife encouraged a string of boys to take part in sexual activity in Warwickshire between 1992 and 1996. Gary, it's the BBC again. It's broadcasting again. What is this strange connection, it seems, between child abuse and broadcasting?
Certain whether it's disproportionate numbers that are actually involved in it or not, or whether it's just that there's a lot more attention paid because of the jobs that people actually do. It's abhorrent, it's unpleasant, and whoever it is, whether they be anonymous individuals or people in the public eye, that action needs to be taken.
Martin, it's not the first time, is it? We've also had a presenter on Radio Bristol jailed as for child sex offences a few years ago, and he was as part of the Prince's Trust. He was meeting many young people and using that to be a predator on them. But what do you make of this connection between, it seems, you know, far more than you would normally expect, people involved in broadcasting and child abuse?
No, I think we know that paedophiles do in fact go in for jobs where they've got access to young people. So you get people, you know, wanting, that's why you have to have DBS checks if you're going to be a teacher or whatever. And I think broadcasting does in fact meet a lot of people, and you meet a lot of young people.
And of course they're all sort of doughy-eyed over maybe the fame in the future, and they're preying on people using that. Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guests, leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. After the Murdoch News, the second terrorist in Britain attack in Britain in as many weeks.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.